Okay, so last year we did deal with the topic of Minhag for 2 weeks, Yair? 2 weeks?
Hello?
Minhag and Lotus go to do, right, were 2 weeks, which were related topics, I think.
Yeah, it was like one of them
that took time. Minhag and Lotus go to do, yeah. So now this will be the third year on Minhag, but from a different perspective. Right? Again, last year we, there was a different focus. So I want to sharpen some of the ideas that we spoke about last year and focus again on the role of the lady on Pesach. So let's start. This Gemara we did mention mention last year. This is a very famous Gemara. The Gemara in Pesachim is dealing with the inauguration of Rabbi Akiva as Rosh Hashiva. Everyone knows this story. Yes. No. Yes. No.
Yeah.
Right, Rabbi Akiva comes, and he sees. Wait, Rabbi Akiva or Hillel? What are you talking about?
Her,
what? Rabbi Akiva, right?
Yeah, you said
Rabbi Akiva. Well, I'm trying to think if I'm right or am I saying the Hillel. If someone has Bar-Ilan, open it up. Now we're brain freezing. But anyways, right, so the Gemara talks, he comes up from Bavel, and they have a Karbon Pesach. He paskins that you can't, carry things, Machshire Pesach on Shabbos. So then they ask, well, then if Pesach is on Shabbos, so how do you get the knife to the Beis HaMikdash? So Amar Lanz, he said to them, Halacha zu shamati v'shachachti. I heard this halacha and I forgot it. Elahanach lahem liYisrael. But leave Yisrael. Ein neviim hein b'nei neviim hein. If they are not prophets, they are the children of prophets. L'machar. So the next day, Misha pischo tlep. Tocho b'tzimro. Misha pischo gdi. Tocho ben karnav. Someone whose Pesach was a sheep, he would stick the knife in the wool. So he wouldn't actually be carrying it. If it was in the, if it was a goat, he would put it between the horns. Ra ma'asev and iskar halacha. So we saw the story, and he remembered the halacha that this is what you're supposed to do. Va'amar kach mikublani mipi Shemaya v'Avtalion. This is what I heard from Shemaya v'Avtalion. Okay. Now last year we spoke about minhagim. I think it's for Hillel, right? I think this is Hillel. I think it's Hillel, not Rabbi Akiva. I'm pretty sure that it is Hillel. It's Hillel, right? Okay. That would just slip then. Okay.
It's like once you say it, you're like, that sounds right, and it doesn't sound right, but okay.
Fine. So last year we spoke about minhag, like minhagim, like practices, like that we do. I don't really want to talk about much practice, but Jacob Katz makes an important distinction between two different things that we mean when we minhag. The way he's been asayach this, and Chaim Soloveitchik brings this down also in his work, is we really mean two different things. We mean minhag and we mean nohag, right? That's just the words he uses, but basically minhag means a custom, I don't know, pick a minhag.
Having kidney eggs with salt on it.
Fine. Kidney oat, right? Kidney oat is a minhag. What? How you wrap your children is a minhag. Those are customs that people do, right? It's not a question of psak, or that's an independent value of minhag. Then there's nohag, right? There's what are people accustomed to do, right? When we talk about the role of minhag in psak, right, we really, they're two separate questions, right? One is, what is the value and force of minhagim, of customs? Maybe we'll come back to that next week, I don't know. Of minhagim per se. The other is the question of the value of noag, right? And we started talking about this last week, right? Last week we spoke about how does practice affect the formulation of law. But the second question, which is, how does practice affect your assumption of what the law is, right? What do you think the relationship is between nohag, between what people are accustomed to do, and what they should be doing, right? The is and the ought, right? How related are the is and the ought? Yes? Right. So again, last week we spoke about it in the context of formulation of law. Right. When you are formulating law, how much you have to take into account what people are doing. But the second question is, when you're deciding not what should be new law, but what is the law, how much of a data point is what people do? Right? We started talking about it last year, but I want to approach it from a different angle. So I want to really identify the issue at hand by really focusing on the medieval example, right? On the, and then do a little bit of intellectual history here in the age of the Balei HaTosfos. So there's a scholarly claim, and we'll see it in a moment, that has undergone several revisions, that there's a tendency amongst the Balei HaTosfos, amongst the Chachmei Ashkenaz, to defend Minog, or more precisely, to assume that that which people were accustomed to do reflected law accurately. Therefore, even when the simple read of the texts seemed to contradict the practice of people, there was a tendency for them to defend the minhag b'shetach. Okay, we're going to examine this claim and some qualifications of it. But if this claim were true in its expansive form, so what would that tell us? Right?
That Nohag creates, like, it tells us.
Yeah, right. The Noach tells us what Psach is. The Noach tells us what Allah is, meaning not just does what people do affect what law should be, right? But what people do is itself evidence of what the law is. Jeffrey Wolf noted to me that the Sefer HaAruch, right, which is a precursor, it's not actually Ashkenaz, but the point comes across in his definition of the word Kahal. Sefer Aruch, second source here. I'm going to be going down the sources here. Right? I even wrote, Hey Ara, me Professor Jeffrey Wolf, and the first one I wrote, Tachshov Nohag Mol Minhag. I even gave you little notes here. Right? So the Sefer Aruch, right, which is basically a medieval, early medieval dictionary, says, Kahal. And when he's translating the word Kahal, so he says, Beperakama Brachot B'Gemara, Meimez Ekorin Eshma B'Shachris, Hey, Rabbi Yosi ben Eliakim, Mishum Kila Kadisha Yerushalayim. So he takes a phrase that comes up several times in the Gemara, Kila Kadosha Yerushalayim, right, the holy congregation of Yerushalayim, and when he's giving it his example of the word of Kahal, that's what he picks. And Jeffrey Wolf pointed out that, right, what that tells you is that what was the first thing that jumped to his mind when he heard the word Kahal, your congregation, right, which means, in other words, community. Right. What was the first thing he thought of?
Holy congregation,
right? There was this tendency amongst Ashkenaz to view themselves as the Kila Kedosha, right? As a holy congregation. Therefore, what they were doing was probably right. Right? Why would they be violating law? If they're doing it, it must have basis. So this was basically the academic claim for a long time, okay? Now, there's no doubt that you do find... Okay. Picking up, now that we have a recorder that has space on it. Okay, so one of the most famous examples, this is like how you start in medieval Jewish history when you're doing Balei HaTosfos, is this famous first Tosfos in Avodah Zarah. Now a little bit of background about Balei HaTosfos, right? Last year, also remember, but this is the time of year I had to do at least one academic share. So we'll do a little bit of intellectual Jewish history. Tosfos Shelanu, right? The Tosfos on the Daf is, for the most part, in most Mesechtos, written by? Realize or Mituch? No, it is a late compilation, right? The Tosafos, right? Tosafos Shelanu is a late compilation. It's not all Realize or Mituch. A lot of them are, but for the most part, they're very late. What does that mean? They're very late.
They base themselves on generations of Tosafos.
Yeah, meaning they compile generations of Balei HaTosfos for your French, German. Some of them are French. Some of them are German. Whatever, right? And Avodah Zarah is particularly late, and therefore reflects a tremendous amount of layers of Tosfos. You get a very good picture for what's going on in the Tosfos period. Right? So there's this famous first Tosfos in Avodah Zarah. Right? There's an Isser in the Gemara to do business with non-Jews, B'yomei Dam, on the day of their Yom Tov, and...
3 days before.
3 days before and 3 days after. Now what's the big problem medieval Ashkenaz?
Christianity,
which al panav, what days of the week should be usher to trade with non-Jews?
All
Sunday, 3 days before and 3 days after, right? You've got 7 days in a week, right? That would be 7 out of 7, right? That would be a problem. So Tosfos has to deal with this question. So Peir HaKundrish to also be Yom Ido Umod Elavos Gachamim. Right, the reason it's Aser is because they go on the holiday and they thank their God. Mitoch Lashano Mashmash Rasolma Af Mechol Memkar. But the business is Aser. Vekasha Masam Cholum Lases Velases Be Yom Eid Elavos Gachamim Imahem. Right, how do people do business on their Yom Eid, on their holiday? Nihi De Rovei Dam Minha Gedoshim Heim Mikol Malkum Chol Shavua Yom Echad Yesh Lahem. Right, in addition to all their holidays of saints, right? Leave those aside, but they have Sunday, right? The Rabbi Yishmael, Olam Aser, according to Rabbi Yishmael, who thinks 3 days before, 3 days after, and Yom Eidam, all 7 days of the week are Aser. But Ein Lomar, the Hainu Time of Mishom, the Ovdei Kol Chavim Shabachos Lars Lav, the Ovdei Avos Kol Chavim, Elamin Gavetim Biyadam. Don't try to justify the way the Gemara in Chulin says that they're not real Ovdei Avos Zara. Right, they're just following the minhag of their forefathers. Amar Shmuel b'Gemara b'Gola eino aser el yom eidam bilvad. Because Shmuel said that, okay, fine, in Galus we don't aser 3 days before and 3 days after. We only aser on the yom eid. Mashma hayom eidam mi aser, but still Sunday should be aser, and people did work on Sunday. So what is Tosfos' assumption? Right, going in, right? What is Tosfos' assumption in this question?
We're doing the right thing.
Right, there's a Gemara that, in a vacuum, if I asked you, if you're not allowed to do business on a non-Jewish holiday with non-Jews, and I told you that Sunday was their holiday, the conclusion would be, in a vacuum, you can't do business. And Tosfos' assumption is, that's not true. We're doing the right thing. Lekach nira. So therefore he says, right now, just watch how many answers you get. Kach nira the sharmi shum eva. So maybe answer one, it's mutter because it would cause hatred. To the Amar Gemara, like the Gemara says, later, Gabri Yehud, and you see it, the Shadr Laila Umina, dinar kisarna b'yom eido. The Yehuda used to send a dinar to one of these people on his holiday. He said, what else should I do? Lo ishkale, if I don't take it, havi le eva, there'll be hatred. Miu, Amy Shum Rayak Mur, that's not a good proof. The Shema Lavi Shum Eva Lishru, maybe it's not Mutukut of Eva, Elohim, no till Eitz, a case of Yasser, Shaloye, Elo Eva. Maybe he was trying to figure out how there would be no Eva. Besides, hatred would only tell us that we can't, you know, that we're allowed to lend them money or borrow and or pay back loans. There's no hatred if you don't do business on Sunday. Right? Okay, so don't do business. Don't sell anything to them. Don't buy something from them, right? Not everyone goes to market every day. You can just say, I don't need to do business today. And how would the guy even know it's because of Yantif? Lekach nira. So answer two. Lekach nira the Tama Hetter Mishum Da Akum Shemenenu Kim Lomgai Lo Pauch Lav Zechavim. They're not over the Avodah Zara. Our non-Jews are not over the Avodah Zara. Mehaita Mashar Lekaman. Mberek Beis Rehuta Deshar Delei Kurbina Le Avidrina Biom Eido Omer Kim Le Begaved Lo Pauch Lav Zechavim. I went back a line. Delo Palach, what we call him from Akiro. No, I did do that right. Delo Palach, let's go. Chavim, fine. Inami, answer three. Yesh, Lismocha, he did Tanib Yerushalmi. Sindaz, Lases, Vilases. Tani, Badbed, Ramurmo, Chamshayim, Makiro. Love him from Akiro, Mother Meneshu, Kemachnev. Answer three. This is only with a random non Jew, but if it's a non Jew that you know, it's mutter flattery. It's mutter sucking up, and it's fine. V'tanya nechnas la'ir u'matan shmeichem sameach imam sheinu el kamach nefuhem. Rabbeinu Tam ayim afareish aser lasid lasim imam dafka b'midid dekrovish. Rabbeinu Tam said the iser is only to do business with things that are related to items they need for avodah zarah. V'lo ayri klal b'liknos. It's not talking about general business. Devadai shari bein lishna azul moda bein lishna delifnei yivir l'shitin. The law also elulim kar dafka midi di tekrovitz lasses lasses hachi perish lasses mehenam moed lasses lahem midi di tekrovitz and lasses right lasses velat. Well, I should do it here Sparty because otherwise it sounds the same. Lasse velate, right? That were better. Right. to give them things related to Avodah Zarah. So it doesn't mean business in general. It means give them that and get money back. Chalifei Amos, maybe Raya. I mean, it might be Gemara. Time imahem imu shem harvacha. Perish mishem harviyach umisakir va'azil modlo v'zchavim odil mishem lefnei evil. See the mechel kamar nafkamin at islay mainly day v'imid lav the krovas. Right, he goes through a whole that defense that it might be about lefnei evil. Fine, and you just skip down. Ulfi perish rabbeinu tam. Right, there's 1, 2, 4, 5 lines from the bottom. Ein litmal minag olam. There's no reason to be astonished at the minag. Shafil amay machzika nosan govdevus kolchavim. Therefore, even if they are idol worshippers, shrei, it's still mutter. Shrei einam osim shum tekroves elo bimaos. Uvazelo shay harvacha v'harbe maos mitzuyim lahem lo sedaver umiu nachonu lahachmer shabav kolchavim omer aveni maos le shakri shagarin or prayer. Right, but if they actually come to you and tell you that they need something for avodah zarah, then you might want to be machmer. Yochanamar kiba osam ofrir ein shum iser. Rabbi Chanan was even matter in this because it's not actually iser. Kimashan osam osam legalachem kamrim eino mamis l'shem avos kuchavim elatzarachanasam because these go to the priests and they're actually not actually for worship. Right, so everybody points to this Tosfos. Right, as a classic good example, especially since it's such a late Tosfos and has so many layers. Right, the Tosfos clearly has a conviction, which is what we're doing is mutter. Right, there's a Gemara. That's one data point. There is what people do. That is a second data point. Right? And then what do we do?
Figure out how they
interpret. Yeah, you have to interpret the Gemara in light of the data point, which is overwhelming in this case, which is that this is what people do. So people like to point to this, right? That there's this tendency in Ashkenaz. And not only Ashkenaz, right? You find other places, but Ashkenaz is dominant. To assume Kehila, Kedosha, we have a holy congregation. If we're doing it, it must be right. And therefore, they take practice, they take nohag as a data point in their actual analysis of halacha. Okay? So that's sort of the broad thesis that academics put forth. The problem is that, right? At least in early Ashkenaz, this is not totally true, right? It's an overstated claim. For example, right? You look at the next line. This also appears in Tosfos, but the reason I put the Rush is because I put the Agotzah tree after. I forgot to bold it, but fine. The Rush. It's the beginning of Bava Basra. The Gemara says that it gives different widths for a wall that you want to build. Between properties, yes? Like if you have two properties, you have to build a wall. Depending on what material you make it of, how thick does it have to be? And the Gemara is, this is only where there's no minag, but if there is a minag, I call it minag amedina. So the Gemara is, I call it minag amedina, I call it asui. My, what does that mean? Asui asut, then he give you hutzavidafna. So that tells you, even if there's a place where the minag is just to put up like a straw fence, that's mutter. Hikra benutam, my by lasuye. What do you mean? What does it come to add? Just say that people do whatever they do. So Rabbi Nutam said, it tells you that only hutzavidafna, only if they at least make a wall of straw between different people's property. Because at least it's somewhat significant. But if they use less, minak shtusu below of dinam light. This is a minak shtus, right, and we don't follow it. So, right, we already have another piece of evidence from the Lactosis that it's clearly not always true. Now, in Echanami, this is not the world's biggest shaila, but we'll get to bigger shailas in a minute. But at least here, right, what does Rabbeinu Tam say? There are such a thing as minak shtus. The Rush comments also, right? The Agos Hashri notes that what the Rush quotes from Rabbi Tam is Mochichem Mikan Sheish Minag Shel Lismoch Alav Avilechad Anan Hakol Keminag Emedina. Now, the next line is from the Agos Hashri himself. Who is the Agos Hashri?
Rabbi Yisrael of Krems.
Thank you, Rabbi Yisrael of Krems, who is the great grandfather of Yisrael Israeline, the author of Shemos Adeshen, which is, if we're going in history now, right, you have early Ashkenaz, and then you have sort of the late Ashkenaz going to the Achronic period. Now, as important as Minhag is in early Ashkenaz, it becomes even more powerful in Leit Ashkenaz, and watch with this astounding statement. He says, "V'lo yadana eze minagu she'ein somchar alav." I know of no minhag that we do not rely on. I think Rabbeinu Tam is wrong. I think that even if it was less than that, we would follow the minhag. Right? So, the picture in medieval Ashkenaz is a little bit complicated, right? Rabbeinu Tam clearly doesn't hold that all minhagim should be defended, but you see that at some level that tendency does appear in late Ashkenaz, right? Late Ashkenaz really does go this way, right? Minhag is even more of a significant data point. If people do it, it must be right. Lo yadati, I know of no such minhag that we don't follow, right? That is the Hagos HaShri. Okay. So, late Ashkenaz, at some level, this thesis is at least more correct. But let's come back for a minute to early Ashkenaz, right? So we said, there's this thesis that we begin with, right, that Ashkenaz viewed themselves as Kila Kedosha and therefore started the assumption that practice is justified. Elamai, we see that in at least one case, when Tom says, no, there's such a thing as minyan kshitos, but fine. The question of how thick your wall has to be between neighbors, okay, it's not the biggest deal in the world. Yes? Agreed? Fine. If I ask you, if in fact this thesis were true, that Ashkenaz assumed they were Kila Kedosha and therefore they defended Minhag, give me some areas of halacha where you would assume Kidavar Pashut that the poskim would defend Minhag at all costs.
Shabbos.
Maybe. Maybe Shabbos. Give me an even better one. What? Better.
Ishus.
Ishus. Why Ishus?
Because it's the most important.
One is very important. All these are important. But more important. What?
Has most lambdas.
It does have a lot of lambdas, but what's unique about Ishus that's not true in Shabbos and Kashrus? Who's in charge of Ishus?
A woman.
The rabbis, right? Meaning, as much credence as you're going to give to practice, kal vachomer you're going to give to something which is both practice and is controlled by people who are themselves Yudea Sefer, right? Who are the rabbanim, right? That gives it tarte lativusa, right? It's not just that people are doing this, it's that the people who are knowledgeable are doing it. Yes? Right, that would be like the first thing I would say, like Gittin, number one thing, right? Like, if you believe that your Kila is Kedosha, you're doing things right, you don't mess with Gittin. Yeah? Look at Rabbeinu Tam. It's technically quoted in a lot of Rishonim, which just happened not to be in Bar Ilan. So I just looked for someone who quoted it. And I found it in a Shut Marashach, but whatever. It's from the Rabbeinu Tam. The Chengaz Rabbeinu Yerucham ain't lazer shum davar begin lahachmer. So Rabbeinu Yerucham said, "Look, don't ever be machmer on gittin. Ratzol me davar sheinu tzarech. Never be machmer on something you don't have to be machmer on gittin. Shalolo hotzi laz again arishonim." Right. So he said, "Never be overly machmer on gittin." Right. One reason is because, right, like I said, I think it's run by the rabbis, but also, right, why is gittin unique to Shabbos and Kashrus?
Because mom's era.
Yeah, I mean, because it creates status issues forever. Right, the Hotzi Laz already shown him, fine. The Heiti B'Shiltei B'Gibarim, the Heiti B'Shiltei G'Barim Alagos Mordechai, Tshuva L'Rabbeinu Tamzal. The Shiltei G'Barim quotes Agos Mordechai, quoting Rabbeinu Tam, that says like this, Hei Shiv Rabbeinu Tam L'Rab Yosef May.
Orleans.
Come on.
Orleans.
Thank you, right? Right, you see, in Chos is often written with a shin, and like some people pronounce it very incorrectly, Orleanish. It is not Orleanish. This is what we would call in English Orleans, right? In French would be like Orléans.
Oh.
Very good. Yeah, good. Okay. What?
Laz is always a shin.
It's always bad. We have no idea to pronounce any of their names. It's like Reed Migash, as one of my you would know this, one of my Tamani friends told me, it is not Reed Migash, it is Yosef Ibn Megas. I'm like, I am sorry. Whoa. Whatever, we don't pronounce right, what can you do? Al Asher Kasavta Al Tovez Aget Shenichtav Al Pi V'Nichtav Bo Ploni Dimiskri. Ploni, this get that you wrote this way, whatever, V'Martish Ani Gorim Laz, I'll get a region him. And you accused me of being motzi laz on the gittin, because I changed it. Shlo nagulik arak ploni v'kol shum mechanicha. Because, right, we follow Rabbeinu Tam here, that we write on a get. Ploni demiskere ploni. Yes. Person who is called X. Right. And then you put all the nicknames. Right. Demiskere X. Hamechuna X. Blah, blah, blah. Anyone ever been to a get?
Thank God.
As I assumed, with our rejector, right?
Yeah,
so you've seen this. Ploni dimiskrei ploni, amuchuna ploni, blah, 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 blah. Right? And in Ashkenaz, they didn't do this, so what are you doing? You're reading Motzi Lazar Rishonim. Hello, so he answered, Umaj the Chit, Mrayasi, Tarashleim, Mesicha, Batela. Vigam Gazavta, Shain, Lishanos, Minagmine, Allahs. Right? So he goes through some of his critiques and he says, and that which you said that I can't change minhag, and he says something with harifas, what does he say? Minhag zeh. Come on, read these words for me. Minhag zeh gehenem limafreya. Right? Minhag is the same letters as, backwards, as gehenem. Right? Don't tell me minhag. Right? This minhag is from hell. Right? That's what he said to him. They're the same words. Read, just see what you're saying. Im shotin nagu, chachamim lo nagu. And if idiots were nohag, then chachamim were not.
Is this the Maharshach series?
No, this is Rabbeinu Tam. Right? This is Rabbeinu Tam. Just quoting it. I said it's not the Maharshach. This is Rabbeinu Tam quoted in Shulta Giborim, quoting in Agos Mordechai. It just happened not to be on Bar Ilan, so I took the Maharshach because I needed somebody who I didn't have to type it out with. Right? Vafilu minag hagun, and even a good minag eino oker halacha. Ve'al tosev od lidamos dimdionos ka'ila, and stop imagining things. Right? Lab madnu shaha minag zarech tanayim rabim. Now this is the Marshach. From here we see that a minag needs many conditions. Vafilu hachi eino moel b'chol davar v'davar levatel halach. It doesn't always help to uproot halacha v'gam zarech alpi v'kiyim, and there needs to be experts. Bukar kasavti sheminag ze lohaya alpi v'kiyim, and this minag was not alpi v'kiyim, etc. Right, so this Rabbeinu Tam sort of throws that thesis into chaos, right? If you really believe that there's an assumption that kihila kedosha and what people are doing is right, the last thing on earth you do is mess with gittin. And if you're gonna mess with gittin, what is the last thing you say? You do not say, right? Literally, the last thing you say is minhag. Minhag is just gehenim spelled backwards, right? That is just not how you treat somebody in gittin. If you really think that, you know, there was this overwhelming force in early Ashkenaz that everything that people did was right, right? You don't say something like that, right? Yes.
What would be the divided language in saying that they consider minhag a powerful force, what the halacha is, and applying to even schus?
One second. Okay. Okay. So let's, right. So, right. The original claim, let's read. Right now we're going to draw heavily on work by Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. Okay. So the original claim was sort of very famously presented by Chaim Soloveitchik in an article many years ago called Religious Law and Change. So the next source, he says, first, the subject of the lecture is conscious change, right? We're talking about conscious change. Reinterpretation of set purpose to achieve a given goal. Second, our subject is not the response literature. So we have to make a chiluk, and this comes to your point, Yair. We will not deal with actual judicial rulings, a sphere where there has always been a strong interplay between circumstances and legal principles, but rather with the theoretical writings of the halacha, literature which one might expect to be immune to pressure. Our remarks will center about the classical super commentary on the Talmud, the work of the Tosafists, the great series of Franco-German glosses composed in the 12th and 13th centuries, printed alongside the Talmud in every edition of that work, and indissolubly associated with every attempt to understand the complex corpus from the Middle Ages to the present day. Right? There are two places where we could talk about nohag, about practice affecting psak. One is in case law. Right? Limud Schus is most often, or Shas HaTzchak, is most often employed in case law. Less mandepalig, that when a rabbi has somebody coming in front of him, screaming and crying, right, and it's a Shas HaTzchak, that what do? They're not Mekil, but they try to be Mekil, right? Any posek with a heart, when the person's in front of them, they try. But that same posek, if he was writing a theoretical work, right, is more likely to what?
be the Mishmat HaDin.
Right, he's more likely to write what he thinks is true in a vacuum. Right? So, everyone agrees that to some extent, practice, you don't want to use the more academic version of it, right, affects the rulings of law. But it more often or more directly affects case law, where someone has the screaming person in front of them. Once it starts affecting theoretical law, right, it's a much bigger deal. Right? Because that means, what does that mean? That even in the vacuum, right, when you don't have the person in front of you, you're trying to set policy, if you still take practice into account, right, that's a much greater statement of the importance you give to practice. Yes? So limud zchus, right, or shas hadchak, right, which are similar, not exactly the same, obviously they're different, right, they're accomplishing different things, but arguments that are made knowing that they're weak, right, come up often, more often in case law, because there you literally have somebody in front of you, and if you are machmir, you're either going to cause them pain or you're accusing them of an iser, which is a hard thing to do. Right? So you're willing, right, when you don't have that pressure, right, you really, 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 really need to believe that practice is important to come up with a limud zchus, or consider it a shas hadchak. Right? It's not impossible, but there is that step removed. The human factor is a step removed from your decision making, right?
I mean, the word in the Gemara, the word skila is all over the place, however, not that they actually gave skila.
Yeah, yeah. So now, right, the Tosfos that we saw at the beginning, right, and the truth is, there's other Rabbeinu of Tam are dealing on which plane? Right? Policy. Right? So there, right, you have one case where Rabbeinu Tam is still, where the Baalei Tosfos are still coming up with what you correctly call a limud zchus, right, despite that distance, right, they're coming up with a limud zchus. And then you have the case of Gittin where one would think you should come up with a limud zchus, but he doesn't even do that, right? He doesn't even say, I think it's X, but I can come up with a limud zchus for Y. What does he do? He just throws it out. He says it's Gehenna, right?
Well, couldn't you agree that the reverse would be the... I mean, you could say that because it's so chamor, despite the usual tendency to think popular presence of count, we can't risk it.
No, not necessarily, because you imply by doing that that everyone who didn't do that is mamzerim now. Remember, it comes with a very real cost. If you think that someone gave apostle get, and then they remarried, their children are mamzerim, then you can't marry them. Right? So it's not like you can say, I could just be machmir now, but if you think this is the Ikar Adin, right.
What if you do is true regardless?
But if you think that right practice tells you what the law is, right? When the cost is that high, you're much less likely to say
that the practice is wrong.
Yeah, the practice is wrong. Anyway, so he continues, many have inferred, and reasonably so, that as the Tosfos were not only scholars but also communal leaders in this community, religious and leaders who intertwine, like all true leaders, they shaped the law to meet the needs of their people. It was noted, however, that often the practices referred to were actually ones of long standing, and the remarks of the Tosfos do not constitute any innovation but are rather a ratification of the status quo. Furthermore, detailed study will show that often the practices referred to were ones that were not under heavier economic social pressure. A good many of the practices allowed by the Tosfos certainly were product of such pressures, especially those in the area of trade or business, but others were not at all. A few that were legitimized were even contrary to the material interests of the community. Right, so here he notes that it's not just right that some of the examples of Baalei Tosfos are essentially close for shas hadchak situations, like the one we saw in the business case. Right? Because that would just tell us what?
That
there's a combination of an assumption that people are doing the right thing and shas hadchak. But sometimes in the Baalei Tosfos you find that they defend minhag even when?
Without the
hadchak. Even when it's against, when it causes hadchak. Right? When paskening along the case of minhag actually makes things harder. Right? A few that were legitimized were even contrary to the material interests of the community. For example, right, the Baalei Tosfos, right, refused, even though they had certain ways of doing this, to get rid of the Yisr of Yayin Nesech, practically. And this is what he's going to quote in a minute. And so the question presents itself, and I emphasize that we're dealing with commentaries and theoretical writings. What legitimized in the eyes of the Tosafists this radical reinterpretation? Reinterpretation actually is a misleading term. More accurately, one should ask, what led them to read the Talmud, to perceive the Talmud, in a fashion which can only be construed as a justification of the status quo? And we're not dealing with a few isolated instances. There are numerous occasions, indeed, in the field of Yayin Nesach, or Yochas Avodah Zarah, entire areas of Talmudics in which one may say without fear of exaggeration, Tosafists have overtly fashioned the laws to align it better with regnant practices and need. Right? And he's written a lot showing that this was true in the case of Yayin Nesach, right? Where on the one hand, they found a lot of kulos in Yayin Nesach. Right, the Baalei Tosafos did a lot of work to find kulos in Yayin Nesach because wine was a very, very central part of culture and it was necessary. On the other hand, there are, and I won't get into the details, there are halachic positions that were in play from very significant people in early Ashkenaz and the Gaonim that, if combined, would have eliminated Yayin Nesach entirely. But the Baalei Tosafos didn't do that. They went out of their way to defend the Isser. Right? So it's not just that they're trying to make things easier. What they're trying to do is defend the status quo. And the status quo is that they treated Yayin Nesach as an Isser, but there were a lot of kulos within Yayin Nesach, right? So it's not just that they're looking for Shas's Chag. There's an assumption that what the practice is. Right? So that's a whole book, right? Correct. They're not just helping the community, they're defending Minhag as Minhag. Right? On this, Dr. Soloveitchik wrote this book. This book, Just on Yayin Nesach, Hayayin Bimei HaBeinayim. He has another book, which is just on business, is just on selling to non-Jews. This is us drinking wine. Then there's another one of us doing business with them. It's a book about this long also. Then he has two very famous articles defending yet another case where this happens, which is martyrdom, right? Has anyone read his famous articles, Martyrdom?
Yeah.
Worth reading, Halacha, Hermeneutics, and Martyrdom, Part 1 and 2.
Yeah, Rebbe just sort of mentioned it during the
age. Okay. Right, where he notes that the Baalei Tosafos, for a while, try very hard to defend the practice of Jews.
That's where she...
Well, giving up their lives, shechting their kids, all those horrible things that they did in the Crusades to prevent themselves, them and their children from being baptized regarding Christianity. Right, so he's done a lot of work in these three areas showing that there is this tendency to an extent. What, Asher?
Huh?
What? Amongst the Baalei Tosafos.
Okay, eat your plot. Let's see how many people convert in Spain.
There's this tendency of the Baalei Tosafos to defend. However, right, as we noted, that there's a corrective on this, right? In Gittin, where you would have thought that if this were true, that for sure, Baalei Tosafos would have defended Minhag. They don't. So in chapter 10 of this book, which is then translated into English, in the new collected writings, but I haven't read it in English because I haven't gotten access to it because a certain Ram who will remain nameless has had the book out of the library for over 6 months. Every time I ask, they're like, we'll get it eventually. Modified his claim because he noted it's just not true, right? There are indeed cases where the Baalei Tosafos really, really, really defend Minhag and assume that practice translates in law, and then there are cases where they don't, right? Little cases like the building of walls between fence, between houses, and then huge cases like Gittin. So here's Gil student summary of it, because otherwise I would have to translate a whole bunch for you in Hebrew and try to copy it. But this was a recent summary by Gil student, which is I think fair. He also put the relevant passages. I added a little bit from it to here. So let's read it quickly, right? Over 3 decades ago, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik proposed that communal self-image played a crucial role in the development of religious law. His revision of that thesis raises questions not only about medieval Jewish history, but also about contemporary Orthodox Jewish society and the much-discussed and perhaps mislabeled turn to the right. Dr. Soloveitchik recently published the first volume of his collected essays, containing a variety of his essays, some updated, some translated into English for the first time, and some brand new. He also includes substantial introductions with his current thoughts on this subject. If I understand correctly, the brief comments, footnotes throughout the book, okay, etc. Fine. Next paragraph. One essay that caught my eye is the important revision of an earlier essay. In 1982, Dr. Soloveitchik published an article that we just read part of, titled Religious Law and Change, the Medieval Ashkenazic Example, included as chapter 9 in this volume. In this article, Dr. Soloveitchik contrasts the attitude Ashkenazic and Sephardic rabbis to religious practice that deviated from authoritative texts. The Ashkenazic Tosfos struggled to justify contemporary practice, while, and now we haven't talked about this yet, while Sephardic rabbis stuck to the text and condemned deviant practices. He explained this, now this is a continuation of that essay that we read before, by pointing to the differences in communal self-image. What we unquestionably have before for us is the way in which a community's self-image can change the course of its legal thought. The Franco-German community was permeated by a profound sense of its own religiosity, of the rightness of its traditions, and could not imagine any sharp difference between its practices and the law and that its members studied and observed with such devotion. The Provençal Jewish community and the Spanish communities, on the other hand, wrestling as they were with, or with what they perceived to be, widespread religious laxity, had no such self-image, and never occurred to the scholars of these communities, many of whom were in every sense the intellectual heirs of the French Josephists, to seek to align their people's practices with the written word. Now I added more from the article. The Provençal Jewish community and the Spanish ones, on the other hand, wrestling as they were... Or more accurately, skip three sentences, I copied a little bit too much. Or more accurately, they never imagined that contemporary conduct was informative of Talmudic law, that the deeds of the common folk were revelatory of the divine intent. The Franco-German community, in its state of intense religiosity, saw the word of God as being, as it were, incarnated in two forms. First, in the canonized literature, i.e. the Talmud, second, the life of its people. If the new dialectical method, with its sweeping coalition of the most varied sources, with its constant juxtaposition of contradictory passages discovered among the contradictions uncovered, was one, not simply between a passage in the first volume of the Talmud and another passage in the last, between a passage in the Talmud and the practice of the God-fearing community, to the Tosafists the problem was one and the same. The resolutional tool of dialectic was and is distinction, and whether the conflict was between two passages in the law or between life and law, to the Tosafists the problems were one and the result the same, a radical interpretation of the halacha. This self-image is unique to the Ashkenazi community. It was not shared by other European Jewish communities in the medieval world. Now back to Gil Student. In other words, Ashkenazic rabbis saw a pious laity and could not imagine that its members would be sinning intentionally or not. Therefore, they sought religious justification for Kamis practices. Sephardic rabbis saw a community that was slipping in its devotion, therefore expended no energy to justify behavior. So let's pause there for a minute. Right, so now we fleshed out the claim a little bit more, right, before we get to the change. Right, the original claim was that the extent to which this phenomenon existed in Ashkenaz and not in Sephard. Now, he posits a difference. Why were Ashkenazim more bound up with Minhag and Sephardim less?
They saw the communities as good communities.
Yeah, I mean, a very simple assumption, right? What assumption does one have to make to take practice, as he says, as a data point when one is poskening, as importantly as one takes text, that the people are right, right? If you have if the poskim perceive that people are not frum, then when you see people sinning, how many data points do you have?
Two.
One. Right, the text. Right, if you assume that the people aren't from, so then does the fact that they're deviating from the proper halacha a data point that needs to be resolved? No. If you assume they're from, then maybe. Right, so the original claim that he made was that Ashkenaz defended Minhag because they assumed people were from, therefore it was a data point like any other that had to be resolved. The Sephardi community did not, and therefore they didn't have to justify it. Now, Dr. Soloveitchik expands on this split, and he further nuances, caveats, is an example. Fine. Now, Dr. Grach has it. Yes?
What if it's clear that they're wrong then?
Wait. What do you mean, clear that they're wrong?
I mean, I read different one of his articles, wrote by Soloveitchik, and he was talking about the Maimonic tradition and like that, right? And he used up.
He has another famous article called, what article are you reading?
The title
Rupture and Reconstruction. Rupture and reconstruction, right? So, so far we've left it in the medieval example, right? Just because I wanted to, before we got to the controversial, I wanted to just like isolate the thoughts, right? Here's another article called Rupture and Reconstruction, which is about?
It's about tradition.
Which is about tradition in the modern era, right? He makes the basic claim that what? That traditional European Jewry, right? He makes a note at the end, I'm sorry, that he's not talking about Sephardi traditions. But
he says that they were transferring it through, like...
Good. That, to the extent that this was true in early Ashkenaz, right, we noted it gets even stronger in late Ashkenaz, and Europe, Ashkenaz, throughout the ages, really followed this, right? And law followed mimetic tradition. People assumed that what their mother and father did was right, and therefore they didn't need to go to a text culture. Then, right, Dr. Soloveitchik makes the argument that what happened? After the Holocaust, you shatter tradition, right? People don't have that communal memory. They're in new communities. So, if you don't have a mimetic tradition, and now you're looking for authenticity, what do you look for? Text, right? In his later, Rupture and Reconstruction, right? This is back to Gilston's summary. I assumed people had at least heard or read Rupture and Reconstruction. He seeks to explain why this is no longer the case. Why has the Ashkenazi community rejected this veneration of practice and moved towards a purely textual religion? Even those on the right with a strong religious self-image fail to follow this pattern. His article attempts to explain this change in attitude. And it's also interesting that some rabbis today have communities with weak religious self-images attempt to justify common practice, which also seems to be against the historic paradigm. Fine. So, Chaim Soloveitchik in that article, like we said, makes the claim that while this was once true, it's no longer true. And he makes the claim that with the Holocaust and moving to America and seek for authenticity without tradition, so text becomes the only barometer and practice really dissipates as a data point in Paskin Halacha. Yeah, Asher.
No, I take point with at the end of the period, right before the Holocaust, he even mentions that they were doing things that were strange. Like, I don't know, like, in terms of, which is, I think, an example of someone paskin a certain way on the shear for something or other, and everyone else is doing the wrong thing. So if they're all doing the wrong thing, and then we decide to uphold something that...
Hold the thoughts for just one second, okay? Just for one second, okay? However, chapter 10 of this volume is a translation of a chapter from Dr. Soloveitchik's 2008 book, Hayayin Bimei HaBinayim, titled here, Religious Law and Change Revisited. In the second look, Dr. Soloveitchik significantly revises his original thesis. It is not true he agrees that the Tosafist justified all religious practices. In fact, Rabbeinu Tam declared non-kosher all the meats eaten by recent generations. That was your example, kashrus, right? And invalidated all the Torah scrolls in Germany. A strong communal self-image did not prevent rabbis from declaring past practices wrong. Rather, Dr. Soloveitchik proposes only practices for which Jews specifically sacrificed greatly were justified. The difference lay in the cost of the observance. When Jews observed their religious practices despite great external pressure, the rabbis strove to validate textually those practices. On other issues, sometimes the Tosafists justified communal practice. Example, early night prayers and clapping on Shabbos, and sometimes they criticize contemporary behavior. This claim is certainly weaker than the earlier. Communal self-image does not explain everything. Even a community with a strong self-image, which sees itself as possessing pious ancestry and devoted laity, will sometimes find its practices faulty when subjected to textual scrutiny. If so, perhaps the changes Dr. Soloveitchik describes in his Rupture and Reconstruction are not part of a new phenomenon, but representative of a long historical trend. While there are multiple ingredients that go into his thesis in that article, the revision of this particular argument may take that argument in a slightly different direction. I anxiously await Dr. Soloveitchik's revised thoughts in the forthcoming volume on the subject. I have not gotten a chance to read it yet, because, again, it is not in the library yet.
So what was the last thing that made them keep things?
Okay, so Dr. Soloveitchik revises his claim, right, because he knows that it's not true, right? A lot of the evidence points in the opposite direction, so he comes up with a different claim. Right? His different claim is, it's only cases where Jews sacrificed a lot for the law that post-game go out of their way and assume that it must be that this is right, right? Like the martyrdom one, right? This is his claim in Halacha Hermeneutics and Martyrdom, right? People gave up their lives for Judaism, right? If you think that that was usher and that was suicide, right? You're criticizing their martyrdom. That's like a... Right, that's like a...
It was wrong.
It was wrong.
Right. But people are starting to do that. But people are very uncomfortable doing that. So he revises the claim. Like, wait, one second. So he makes the claim that perhaps only some minhagim. Now, I don't know whether this claim is right or wrong. What I think is true is the following, okay? Let's leave aside the detail, right? With this sort of little exercise in medieval Jewish intellectual Jewish history shows is the following, right? It's not quite true. Now, there are generations more, generations less. It is true that, one, if poskim view their constituents as fundamentally from, then all things being equal, yes? All things being equal, they will have a tendency to come down and assume that it's mutter. All things being equal. And that, I think, is true. Right?
You think that people automatically just do the right thing? I mean, like, even if...
If
you're in a firm household, I don't think that you automatically do the right thing. Sometimes you just start doing the wrong thing because you think...
If people are firm, right, I think it's true that, let's say you have 50-50, right? Let's make a very easy case, right? You now are left with a beautiful chakira from Rabbi Tarrigan. There are literally only two sides in the entire world to this chakira, right? One would say that something is usher, one would say is mutter, and you can see both sides equally. And then you see that all your good frum Jews for generations have been following the nafkamina that comes from one side, right? So you have no particular interest in one side or the other. So what are you going to assume? Which one is probably right, la halacha? Okay, right, that I think is true. That I think is hard to deny, right? That if you literally think that you equally could see both sides of the question, and from Jews for generations have been following one side, so that should be a significant data point that'll push you to one side. Yes? Maskim? Okay. Beyond that, I think he's right that you will give more weight to practice the more from you assume the people to have been doing this are. Yes? I think that's true. What is definitely also true, when you look at the example of the Balei Tosfos, is that contrary to what, you know, was proposed at the beginning, that's not always true. Right? If you think something is wrong, then it's wrong. Now, what we noted a lot last year is that most of these things are on a sliding scale. Right? There are things that you think are totally possible, right? And things that you think are totally impossible, and then there's a whole bunch of things in the middle, right? If something is, in your mind, 55-45, right? Like, you don't have a strong inclination to say that this is wrong. In a vacuum, you would have said something's wrong. But, like, you could see the other side. It's not crazy. It's just like you're slightly, mildly, very slightly less convinced of the other side. But then, Gantz Klal Yisrael Paskins the way that you're not convinced by, so you're probably going to allow that to be a data point that's going to push you in the direction of Paskining the 45%. Yeah, still agreeing with me? Right? Now, the question is, what if something's not 100 or 0, something is 90-10, right? Or 80-20. So we noted last year in the context of Tikkat Halacha B'Shadat Chak from Rav Aharon that basically all halachic decisions take into account how plausible do I think something is with a combination of what are the counter pressures. A great enough counter pressure might convince you to paskin based on what you think is only 20% likely. A very large counter pressure, right? A less large counter pressure might only push you from to paskin like a 40 in a 40-60 split. Right? The same thing was not just true of Shas HaKlok, the same is true of practice. Right? If you're totally convinced something is wrong, so we saw, Gittin, the cost is high to say that Gittin are Psulim. Right? And other examples are in town. He said that all food was treif. Right? Or he said that all Sifrei Torah in Germany were treif. Right? There's a big cost, but he was convinced that it was not true. But let's say, you know, he was Mesopic. Yeah. What? Yes, he thought they were all possible in Germany. Right? So I think the same model applies here, right? That there are going to be cases where you're totally, totally convinced that something's wrong, and then you won't poskin like it, and you'll try to change what people do. But then there are going to be cases in between, right? Where you're not sure, right? You lean in a certain direction. 60%, 70%, 80%, but you're not totally convinced. So then you're open to counter pressures pushing in the opposite direction. But in order for those counter pressures to mean something, you have to assume that they are legitimate counter pressures, right? So as we came to the conclusion really last year, and I think sort of this, you know, retraction by Dr. Soloveitchik highlights, right? It's not the case. It's never been the case. I mean, there were times in ESCO where it was more or less the case. It's never been the case that practice was so powerful, right, that literally nothing could make you overturn it, right? We saw that to some extent, right? The Agos Ashri almost goes in that direction, right? I've never found a minhag that's wrong. It doesn't, in theory, rule out that possibility. Different people, though, give different amounts of weight to practice when they're poskening, right? Now, of course, how much weight they give depends on, first of all, on their personal inclination, second of all, on their self-perception of the community, and third, on how much weight they give in general to text law versus mimetic law, right? To texts over actual practice, right? Someone may just have a tendency to assume that texts are not as authoritative as we sometimes think of them because we live in a text culture, right? So what conclusion would we draw from it? Well, what conclusion do I normally draw from things?
They're complicated.
Things are complicated, right? That it's a tug of war, right? These are two counter pressures, right? I think he's right. The more people sacrifice for a particular halachic position, the more of an assumption you have that people are doing the right thing, that they're frum or they're knowledgeable or whatever, the more you're going to take that into account when you're poskening and when you're determining what's right. On the other hand, right, that's not absolute, right? There are going to be cases where you're just totally convinced that something's wrong, and therefore, yikuv adin es ahar, and it doesn't matter if everyone's going to, right? It doesn't matter if motzi laz al rishonim and gittin and kashrus and, right, and sifrei Torah and whatever. Now, as Gil's student correctly points out, right, this should revise. What?
Who is the student?
He's the editor in chief of Torah Musings. He's the head of OU Press. He's a very interesting guy. This should lead to a revision of rupture reconstruction, right? Of this notion that this dichotomy, saying that it used to be we followed mimetic traditions even if they were against halacha, right? And now we follow text even if it's against minhag, right? Is a little bit overstated, right? It's somewhat true, right? But it's a question of scale. It's definitely true that when you have a stronger mimetic tradition, right, you're going to pay more credence to the mimetic tradition than you are, right, in a purely textual world. Once minhag is shattered, right, or you assume that people are not frum, so then
you're going
to start going more to text-based, and it's going to be a balance, right? And I think that's basically the only conclusion you can draw, right, from this, right? So last week we spoke about the extent to which what people do affects how one formulates law. Today what we're doing is the even more murky question, which is how much does people do affect what I think the law is? And we saw there's a range, right? If you think your community is frum, and people were sacrificing for this, and there's a whole bunch of reasons why you don't want to, you know, to impugn people's practice, then unless it's mamish, 100-0, you know, it is 100-0, so yikuv adin es ahar, right? Text is important in Judaism, right? Sources are important. But if there's a heavy reason, because people practice this way, they gave up a lot for it, so then you're going to try to find a way to justify it, because practice is important. It is a data point. Right, if it's something which is minor, not that significant, or your community is not that frum, and people don't say it doesn't really make a difference, so then you're much less likely.